All right. It's Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Last week, the world's 50 best restaurants list came out. And about a minute and 23 seconds after the list was announced, the articles started pouring in about how the list is broken, about how it's too Eurocentric, almost exclusively male, and comprised of restaurants that are mostly testing menu only and well above what you might consider an affordable price point. So is the list fixable? Is it worth fixing? We called Christine Malky, a BA contributor, who was actually at the event announcing the list last week in Bilbao, Spain. And we also got in Julia Kramer, our deputy editor, who oversees restaurant coverage for Bon Appetit, and had a bit of a roundtable. Asked a lot of questions. I think we had a couple good ideas of how to sort of improve the list, if it is improvable. Oh yeah, one thing. There are a few curse words sprinkled throughout this episode. So if you're listening to someone sensitive to that, maybe youngsters, do earmuffs and help you forgive us. All right, let's do this. Here is Christine, Julia, and I. So Christine, you were in Bilbao, Spain a few weeks ago at the World's 50 Best Restaurants event. What was that like?
Comparisons to the Academy Awards are accurate.
Really? How so? I'm like, all right, this sounds good.
A lot of step and repeat, or for me, trip and repeat, because I was just trying to get out of everyone's way. You know, really high production. The city's put a lot into it. And on stage, it was very James Bond. I mean, there's a lot of high tech stuff going on. Men in tuxedos, women in gowns. There are a lot of blowouts, you know.
Wow. So it's full on.
It is fully full on.
You know, the list started, I want to say, in 2002, I believe, was the first list.
Sounds right.
What was your sense about sort of when it ascended to this more sort of high-gloss, big production value event?
I mean, considering that the first one was conceived of in a pub that didn't even serve food, I'm going to say around 2010, I remember going to an event, a lunch for it at Per Se, and realizing, you know, the power that it had. And then, I mean, really in the last, I would say, 7 years, it's been huge.
Yeah. I guess it's somewhat comparable stateside to the James Beard Foundation Awards, in the sense that the James Beard Awards have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over
Yes.
the years also, in terms of production value, social media, all of that.
Sure. But in terms of moving the needle for restaurants, I mean, nothing can compare to 50 Best. Moving the money needle.
Well, absolutely. And Julia, what are your thoughts on that? As someone who sort of monitors the restaurant world, who is somewhat, you might call yourself a critic. I don't know if you call yourself a critic.
But sure.
How do you perceive the 50?
I think it speaks to a very different audience than the Beard Awards. I mean, the Beard Awards are very American. They're very sort of hometown. They're, you know, divided by region. You have places that are really sort of embedded in their communities. The 50 Best, I feel, is more geared toward a distinct group of people who travel the world looking to eat at restaurants to check off the 50 best list.
Right. They're called gastronauts.
Gastronauts, yes. Yeah. Also known as, quote unquote, total foodies. and you will know that within the minute of meeting many of them.
Yes.
There's a lot to unpack here. I think one thing that's interesting, you talked about that, Julia, about the 50 best list. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that the people who go to these restaurants want to say a lot that they went to the 50 best restaurants. So they go to those restaurants. So then those restaurants end up being on the list next year.
Well, it depends on those people, because they're dependent on voters and regional judges.
Meaning
chair
what?
People.
Yes.
I think it's divided into something like 28 regions around the world. Anyway, and each region has something like 36 voters, and then there's a chairperson who wrangles the voters. And so each voter has to, they have to check off a box on online voting. And of course, this is now monitored by Deloitte, so it has to be has to be good that they have, in fact, eaten at that restaurant within the last 18 months. And each voter gets to choose 7 restaurants.
Yeah, and there's some question about how much can you travel? How many restaurants can you actually go to personally? So we can get into like the how male and Eurocentric nominated this list is, or you can just get into the list itself in terms of its validity.
Let's start with how male and Eurocentric.
How do you separate them?
Okay, all right. Kramer, you're up to bat. Let's go.
So I think this year there were 4 restaurants on the list that had a woman chef,
and
3 of those women were co-chefs with a man. And last year, Dominique Crenn was given the dubious award of best female chef, and her restaurant was included on the list at number 83. And then
Dominique's chef in San Francisco.
Yeah. And then after she spoke out against the 50 best and the way that they had sort of strangely segmented women into their own category and that many of their regions didn't have a single woman on the voting committee, this year she wasn't included on the list at all. So were people talking about that in...
Not, no. And actually, I actually gravitated toward the women on this trip, who I presume were judges. I don't know.
When you say gravitated toward the women, meaning what?
People that I spoke to at events or...
So just chit-chatting and
chit-chatting.
Stuff.
Yeah, there was an amazing woman who actually launched Food and Wine Mexico City.
Okay.
Lily was really cool. Lily Lopez. Another woman, Paula, from Peru.
And were they voters?
I mean, you're not supposed to say, right? I mean, is there a handshake that I don't know? I'm not sure. But... Yeah, I mean, the whole thing felt very high-five masculine. But no one was actually speaking about Dominique Crenn, which was interesting.
And were people speaking about the lack of women on the list?
Oh, yeah, everybody. I mean, how could they, you know, even now when you have this chance and you know, they had staked a claim to want to change things and then to just almost kind of put the whole boat in reverse in some ways. It's just kind of... it's a head scratcher.
I mean, what do you think has to happen for chefs to, I don't know, like rescind the award? I mean, how far does it have to go until this changes?
I think it's great that the media is so pissed about this. And there have been really a lot of pieces just from Jonathan Gold, Ryan Sutton, Helen Rosner, I think did something just saying this is bullshit.
Yeah, and the numbers are right there. So it's not like you even have to, it's not an opinion. It's just, all right, here are the numbers. It's right, it's in black and white in front of you. I guess the bigger question, though, Julia, is let's say we agree that something should be done, something needs to be done. Well, how do you go about affecting change when you have this panel of sort of, I guess as chefs, journalists, and gastronauts.
Super foodies, total foodies.
Yeah, so how do you affect the way they vote or the restaurants that they consider?
Well, I think you have to change the people who vote.
Yes.
Okay. It's meaning what?
So, as I mentioned, one of Dominique Crenn's objections was that so many of these committees are made up of only men.
Right.
And I think that, you know, this is something that the James Beard Award Foundation struggles with as well, in terms of they made really big efforts this year to have a more diverse and inclusive list of nominees. But I'm actually curious, like, how much did they change the people who are on the committees? And right. I don't know the answer to that. And I don't think that like real change happens until you look at that, not just who gets the nominations, but who's making the nominations.
Yeah.
And I think one challenge with the 50 best and a lot of awards, and I've had this problem with the Beard Foundation, is that I don't think there's anything nefarious going on, but I do think there's often a lack of transparency in terms of how these awards are judged. And I remember talking to the Beard Foundation a few years ago about the journalism awards, and I was like, I'm the editor of a food magazine. I have no idea who votes on these awards. And I did know that, you know, Christine Mulkey here and also Andrew Knowlton at our magazine had been in the industry for decades. They'd never been asked to vote. And I'm like, so who are you asking?
I found out once. Because when I was at the New York Times, we weren't allowed to submit anything for competition because they felt that it was too opaque and too, you know, just especially this was sort of 2008, everything was going down.
Yeah.
And I asked them and they sent me the list and it's not exciting.
No, and it's not as deep or as diverse or as comprehensive as you would often like. And
right.
So I guess, and to your point, Julia, then do you say, all right, obviously, like if we have 1,000 voters, 500 should be female. I mean, that seems easy or obvious,
can
right?
Can I raise my hand here? Actually, in May, I went to Paris. There's this new awards thing starting called the World Restaurant Awards, and it's trying to go up against 50 Best. One of the founders, Joe Warwick, was one of the original men who started the 50 Best list, and he's got IMG backing him and blah, blah, blah. So because I went to the to a discussion about it, and because the French government is giving them money, they mandated that at least 50% of the judges have to be women.
Okay.
So it was really cool to actually go to a food event. I mean, at first it took me a minute because before they had made that announcement, I was like, wow, this feels really different. This is weird. Oh, I'm not the only woman.
Yeah. How much did that affect the list itself, do you think?
Well, the list hasn't been formed, okay. But I did get kind of mean-girled in one of the panel discussions because I was voting for full transparency and that not only should we be transparent, you know, in terms of like, I think we should all pay for our meals and our flights. And then I got kind of ganged up
on. And that brings up a whole other issue in terms of how these restaurants are accessed. And if people want to travel the world, they often need help. And whether it's the Australian right. Tourism Board or the Peruvian Tourism Board or whatever, that like, well, how are you going to get halfway around the world to eat at this Michelin 3-star restaurant? Well, someone's going to help you.
Well, yes, tourism boards are a huge part of this. Sponsors are a huge part of this. And I mean, we should look really toward the sponsors for a lot of this. I mean, it's interesting that Lima had 6 restaurants on the list. Lima.
You know?
But then people were kind of saying, oh my goodness, can you believe it? Australia only has 1 or 2 restaurants on the list and they hosted last year. They spent millions of dollars to get people there to go to the restaurants and only 1 restaurant made it after all that. And Favikin's not on the list anymore. And that, you know, the Swedish Tourist Board had a huge, huge push years ago getting everyone into the middle of nowhere to go to these places. So, I mean, I think that the judges and all of those things are definitely need to be shaken up, and there needs to be a lot more transparency, and there need to be different types of restaurants that are chosen. I mean, looking back, Lauren Collins wrote an absolutely fantastic article for the New Yorker a couple years ago that everyone should just put this on pause and go read that article. It's so great. And you know, there used to be all kinds of restaurants on the list, and now we all say that it goes towards European, prefix, super expensive. So when I was there, of course, there's a lot of rumor mongering. And the rumor was that Eshtabari, which I still can't pronounce correct, but which is, you know, a Basque asador, a grill place that had started out very humbly and has gone a little bit more toward fine dining in terms of what's set on the table, but not actually what's in your now fancy dish. There was a rumor that they were going to make it #1. And that was so exciting because I went there and I was like, OMG, this is actually the world's best restaurant to me at that moment. Yeah. Because it was honest, it was family run, it was beautiful, it was pure, there were no sauces, it was just smoke, it was like pyrotechnics, and it's one man and 6 grills and a couple of people helping out. You know, it was not fancy, there was no theater, I didn't play a card game, and and I was like, yeah, that would be fucking awesome if this were the yeah. world's best restaurant, and it actually was, and it wasn't trying, and it wasn't wooing judges and yeah. those kinds of things. And but it was #10.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And I'm of two minds of this because, A, what the hell does that even mean, the world's best restaurants? Like, what bothers me about the list, one of the things that bothers me is this sort of supposition of how it's a definitive, comprehensive list reached by sort of almost scientific, you know, right. computations, and this is objective. And it's like dining is, it's subjective.
Yes.
And what your favorite restaurant might be is completely different than what mine might be.
Yes.
And to suggest that this is like, you know, the world golf rankings and Tiger Wood has whatever. It's just like, so I don't know. That always drives me nuts that there's this competitiveness. Like, well, we're #1 and you're #7. So we're 6 spots better than you.
Right, right.
Like, meaning what?
Meaning what? I guess it can be a difference of up to 10 votes. And then that can be, that's.
But what does better even mean in terms of
no,
a restaurant?
No, I mean, one of the restaurants.
Like, you have better china than this place or better flowers?
Yeah, and better hand soap and better, you know. But one of the restaurants that was in the top 10 multiple, I probably met 10 people who had dined at that restaurant during this time, and they were all like, what was that?
In a
that
good
was
way?
Awful. No, oh. there was a dish of like, I won't even go into it because it was so intellectually challenging. It just completely bypassed good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the top 10.
So in Lauren Collins' article, there was the quote about the South American restaurant where there was one dish described as like Patagonian rainwater on moss. And like the description of the dishes, like you're like, you didn't know whether this piece was like a send up or whether these were actual dishes served.
Right. Right.
And it seems like there is a type of restaurant.
There is a type of restaurant. I mean, if you, with each slide that went up, you know, and they had kind of a teaser or when they would show the restaurant and there was a plate of food from that restaurant and almost to a letter, it was, you know, a dot and a squiggle and a flower.
Yeah.
Except for Barago in Chile, which was really amazing. And it looked like, you know, a meteor that had fallen to earth and exploded. And that excited me. Or Eshtabari, which is like a piece of grilled meat. And that was great. But everything else had like, you know, the bloop and the gel and the flour. And it was like, I don't want to, I'm not hungry. I left that not hungry. I actually didn't eat after that event. And you know me.
Yeah, no, you've got an appetite. Kramer, what's your take on the type of restaurant or the food that's often sort of makes it on this list?
I saw you looking at me when Christine mentioned the card game
or something. Well, that was an 11 Madison Park reference. That was the number one restaurant in the world. Was it last year or two years ago?
Last year.
They closed for 4 months to do a bunch of work. And so that kind of set them back to the number four spot. But we'll get to them in a moment.
Yeah, I think that type of meal is very fun. I'm not trying to like rain on someone's parade who really enjoys
Patagonian
that
rainwater.
I'm not trying to rain on the Patagonian rainwater, you know. But it's just one very specific type of dining experience. Like it is so not representative of the best things to eat in the world.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that experience. And so Kramer and I were at 11 Madison Park a few years ago together.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that.
And so Will Gadara and Daniel Hume, who run the restaurant, and they're great. And they were very intent on reaching the number one spot. And that is a restaurant that really puts service first. And it wants you to feel cosseted and taken care of. And like it wants you the meal to be exciting and fun. But I'm also like at this point, and when Will came out, I'm like, can we do this meal in under 3 hours?
I went there 8 months pregnant, and I was like, dude, I have to be out of here in 2 hours. And what Pete's story had just come out about saying I was there forever.
Yeah.
And I scooted out on that. They had me literally out like 9:59. It was brilliant. And as I left, I passed another editor, and she mouthed, how did you do that?
We ended up being there for a while, but it was fun. I had a good time. We had a fun
time. It is a
time.
Good time. It is a good time.
But it's – so anyways, my point is like reaching that number one spot. It's like – and part of me is like, why is restaurant as competition like number one, you know, tennis player in the world? It just seems absurd. But then if you look at a restaurant like Noma that reached the number one spot some years ago, like were it not for the 50 best list, Noma would not be Noma. Rene Redzepi would not be as acclaimed as he is. And Rene Redzepi is a fascinating, engaging, magnetic, sort of magical chef.
Yes.
And so, and same with El Bulli before that. And it's like, okay, and in that sense, like I understand why a list like this can or should exist and that there is good that comes of it. I mean, what's your take on that, Julia?
I don't know. I just like, it's very hard for me to care about this list. Just gotta be totally honest.
But you can't not care about it. That's the thing because it's such a thing.
I personally cannot care about this list. In fact, I think part of the problem is us talking about the list.
But that's the internet. If everyone's talking about it, then you got to talk about it too. Because if they're saying something, and if Christine's going to Bilbao, Spain, Christine Mulkey, for Christ's sakes.
I wanted to see it.
Yeah. You know?
Would you go again?
To Bilbao?
To the debut of the list.
No. And can I just put in a little note? So I met William Drew, who's the sort of the chief editor of the group. I was in Sochi, Russia for a food event.
Oh my God.
I don't go to these things. I mean, just as a former Times person, you're not allowed to go on junkets. And then Adam was also really great about saying, you know, we never go on these things. And so I met him, but I went to Russia because how can you not go to Russia in February? That's just too weird. You have to do it. And William was telling the story the other night, said, "Christine, I'm so glad you're here. I didn't think you'd come." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when I invited you in Russia," and he said, "Christine, you have to come to the awards in June," you said, "Why?"
So what flipped for you? Why were you like, "Oh, okay, I want to check this out"?
I want to check it out because I honestly thought that they would change it. I honestly thought that they would come up to date, given the pressures, not pressures, but given the incredible changes that have happened in the industry and changes that have to happen and the spotlights, you know, around so many things, you'd think that they would react more quickly. And I wanted to be there for it. And also, you know, the chefs, many of the chefs who are on the list are forces for good, and this does help their business enormously. Like, I'm a business booster, and I see how this can help them open research labs and hire more people. And, you know, the people who are on this list are doing good things with their success. They're not opening casinos. They're opening fermentation labs, or, you know, they're hiring more local people. And they're not jerks. And honestly, like, they can't survive without this list, some of these restaurants. But you can also argue, well, if you didn't spend so much money on card games or, you know, China or all these things that you think are what's going to get you on the list, then you would actually be able to run a more profitable restaurant. But as we know, restaurants are not profitable businesses.
So, I mean, I see your point. Like, there are a lot of people there whose restaurants have like a social justice mission, like a, you know, environmental justice mission, all these things. So, like, I almost could see how one of them could go up on the stage and there could be sort of like a, you know, Adele moment where they're like, you know, I don't deserve this. Like, this system is broken. I'm not accepting this award.
Right. That would have been amazing. Yeah. When Massimo Bottura was saying, "We are the revolution, we are the change," I'm like, for what? I mean, I think what he's been doing with the soup kitchens in various cities is definitely interesting and not Vegas. But yeah, I'm not sure which revolution he was referring to.
I mean, getting back to what you were saying, Julie, about changing the list, I do think what seemed to be effective was with the Beard Foundation last year, that there was a directive from the foundation to the voters and saying to keep in mind in the sort of in light of all the sexual harassment allegations that you should consider the character and quality of the chefs and restaurateurs and who they are and what they bring to the table and not just the food or the dining experience. And it seemed like that did impact the results of the awards this year. Do you think something similar could make sense for the 50 best?
Well, it sounds to me like people are putting their eggs more in the basket of just creating other awards.
As a reaction to the 50 best, the issues they have with it.
Yeah. Yes. Is that, I mean, that's what I gather from what you're saying about your trip to Paris.
And I see part of that as stemming from, you know, public perception, and Lauren really tapped into that really well about how the judges or many of the voters are kind of bought off by these tourist boards. And it just seemed really kind of bloated and not fair and not cool. And so, yes, let's change it. But I'm just, once there's money involved and sponsors involved, like, can you really be clear and good?
Yeah, it's hard. And it's hard for there to be awards of this, I mean, a global awards without money and bureaucracy and all that stuff is pretty hard to pull off. And I think what was interesting about that initial list back in 2002, and it was kind of done on a lark, and the restaurants were far flung and some high, some low. It was almost like a list from Spy magazine from back in the day. We're just going to throw 50 restaurants out there. You're not going to be able to figure out how or why they got on there.
Right.
But like, that's why I always like a list like Julia, like whether you do or Jonathan Gold or whomever, it's one person's take on something and it's their opinion and it sort of appeals, and you know it appeals to what their tastes are, and they can be all over the place, just like anyone's tastes are. It's like, not everyone goes to fancy restaurants every night, you know? And yet this list is just fancy restaurants.
Right.
Of a not in a particular type of fancy restaurant.
I might be interested in the best, like 200 to 249. Like, I want to see the cutting room floor and what didn't make it.
So I went to Osteria Francescana, which is Massimo Bottura's restaurant in Modena, about 5 years, 6 years ago, maybe. I was there for a work event in Milan and Condé Nast thing. And Jim Nelson is the editor of GQ. And Jim is a person who will travel for food.
Yes.
And
he might be a voter and we just don't know
it. He should be. He definitely gets around. So he's like, "Do you want to go to Osteria Francescana?" And I was like, "Sure. I mean, I guess we have a free night." And like, "Well, how far is Modena?" And like, I don't know, I think it's like 90 minutes away or something. And So I was like, well, we got nothing better to do. Okay. So first of all, so we drive there, and like Massimo, like if you meet him, he's one of those just, he's kind of a magical person. Yeah. His wife, Laura, who's American, as warm as could be, really genuine. They're a sort of a wonderful couple to sort of run a restaurant. It was not my kind of restaurant. I was like, okay, it's a little... this is not a comment on the food. It's more just the vibes. There were not a lot of vibes. That you're kind of in these small rooms with some modern art on the wall, and it's very quiet. And I like something a little bit more energetic or a bit more glow or more vibes. Like, that's not Francescana. And, you know, I think Jim and I left there like, okay, that was interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, glad we went. But I was not like, oh, my God. That's the best restaurant I've ever been to. That's the best restaurant in the world.
Right, right.
And that's not, but again, that's not to say some people don't think so, but I just, that was my opinion that I just, it did not even occur to me.
Right.
So why is there so much support for this awards among the chef community? Like, it just seemed like everyone was there.
Because it can transform your business. I mean, if you don't show up, they hold that against you. I remember there's a quote in Lauren's piece about Eric Repair telling Dave Chang, just go. You have to go. I mean, I think one year Eric sent, he couldn't go, so he sent Maggie LeCose or Mandy Ozer, who was working with him, and they like called him about it. 49 of the 50 chefs were there, and the one who wasn't there was Alain Ducasse, who refuses to go ever. Even he said if he's number one, he'll never go. Because he thinks the awards are bullshit.
I also think a big reason it's held in a scene like it is that every industry likes to have its awards. Mm-hmm. You know, in the magazine world, you either have like the National Magazine Awards or you have the James Beard Journalism Awards. You know, obviously the Grammys, the Emmys, et cetera, et cetera. It gives everyone a chance to get together, pat themselves on the back, pat each other on the back. Running a restaurant, as we all know, is a really, really, really hard thing to do, whether the labor involved, the profit margins, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And if you have a chance to get together with all these other chefs and drink and then go out and drink more and have lunch the next day, it's a moment to sort of, you know, enjoy yourselves. And I don't fault them for that. That's something that every industry does. And I think that aspect of it is good. Like, yeah, you guys should take a bow, men and women.
And they bring their teams. Yeah. I mean, they come with full posses so that everybody gets to celebrate together. And for these events, I mean, this is the first awards event that I've been to, but when I go to like symposiums or, those kinds of things, what happens in the sort of in-between time or the green room time can be really interesting, or those offside meals. Like I've watched chefs form partnerships that wouldn't have happened otherwise. You know, they weren't going to be in the same place at the same time. And that's sort of those chance happenings are the most interesting parts of these things to me.
Do you think the list would have reflected more change this year had the organizing body who runs the awards been American?
Oh my gosh. I can't even. Yes.
Just like given the sort of the Me Too enlightenment here, I think it seems like Americans are much more conscious of and aware of this, and there's much more efforts being made in this country. Something about that list seems very
opposite
first
of
woke. Class lounge in airports in
Emirates,
Switzerland. And,
right.
Yeah, Emirates. And it's like, I don't know if there is tapped into what's going on in our society as
it is. How can you not be?
Maybe they're just, when you're in the first class lounge, you've got your little, mimosa. And
you're not reading the Times.
Maybe you aren't, though. I don't know. Kramer, what do you think?
I should only hope so, yeah.
I mean, let's just say if they don't fix it next year, then huge problem.
Right.
Game over.
But to Kramer's point, though, when will some chef who is receiving these awards actually say something? Because like you see all those photos if you read Eater or whatever, and there's lots of chefs looking like they're having a really good time and celebrating and partying, and there wasn't a lot of consternation, it seemed.
No, I mean, I left like 25 minutes after the awards, but because I couldn't deal. But I would say no to that. No consternation.
Yeah. Kramer, any parting thoughts? How are you going to change the list?
Yeah, I feel like after there was such an outcry after last year's awards that I would have said after last year's, all right, well, if they don't fix it for next year, then there's going to be then it's going to, you know, implode or something. And then it just happened the same way this year. So right. It's just kind of like...
Right. And Dominique Crenn has been extremely critical of them, and nothing reflects that.
That's what's interesting. It's kind of Groundhog Day. It's very tone deaf. So Lauren Collins' piece in The New Yorker, Who's to Judge? The pub date was November 2nd, 2015.
Okay.
So this was 3 years ago.
Wow.
And it's basically touching on all the exact same things we're talking about.
And there's
now.
A great quote there from Alan Jenkins. I think he's with the Daily Mail. He said, "We know this thing has just become a juggernaut, and the brakes are a bit shit."
Yeah. Very British. And on that note, I don't know if we'll solve anything, but it was fun talking about it. Christine Mulkey, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julia.
I work here, so.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.